You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Thank you so much for joining us. For those of you who were standing in the back, I think they brought in some additional chairs, so I hope you can find a seat. My name is Tamara Wittes. I'm director of the Center for Middle East Policy here at Brookings, and delighted to welcome you to this morning's event, which kicks off a weekend of dialogue for us, our 13th annual Saban Forum, in which we bring together a group of senior American and Israeli leaders from politics, from business, from the media, from civil society to talk about the future of the U.S.-Israel relationship and the issues that face us together in the Middle East. This morning's event is also part of what's become a long tradition in starting off our Saban Forum. My friend and colleague, Shibli Telhami, who's a non-resident senior fellow here at Brookings and also the Anwar Sadat Professor of Peace and Development at the University of Maryland and has been a core part of Brookings' work on the Middle East for a long time. Shibli conducts regular polling, both in the United States and in the region. He's been doing this for a long time. And it's become a feature of our Saban Forum weekend that we kick off the closed-door deliberations with a public launch of a polling that he's done on American attitudes toward Israel and toward the Middle East more broadly. And that's what we're doing again today, with a particular focus on the question of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, both as President Obama prepares for his final weeks in office and as we prepare for the inauguration of President-elect Trump. I am really delighted to have with us this morning to discuss Shibli's polling and his findings, two fantastic analysts of U.S. foreign policy, Sarah Yerkes, whom I've had the real pleasure of sharing office space with this year. She's been a visiting fellow with us in the Center for Middle East Policy. And Sarah came to us after serving with distinction at the State Department, both in the Policy Planning Office and in the Israeli-Palestinian Affairs Office. And she's also a fellow Georgetown PhD. And not quite with us yet, but on her way, is the wonderful Karen DeYoung, associate editor and senior national security correspondent for The Washington Post. Karen is about as seasoned as they come in reporting on foreign policy in this town. She's followed all the twists and turns of Secretary Kerry's efforts to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And she's now focused on understanding the challenges facing the incoming Trump administration in the Middle East. So I'm grateful to her for joining us this morning as well. I'm going to ask Shibli to come up on the stage to present the main findings from his poll, which is so fresh that it literally was in the field last week. Isn't that right? So this is not just hot off the presses, but hot off the phone lines poll data. So Shibli will present his findings on the big screen here, and then the rest of us will join him up here for a conversation, first between the group of us and then with all of you. And I look forward to that. I'd ask you, too, if you tweet, that you follow along with us and tweet using our hashtag, Saban16. At the beginning of our Saban Forum weekend. So thank you very much, and Shibli, the floor is yours.
Thanks so much, Tamara. It's always a pleasure to do this, and thanks to Sarah and Karen for joining me on this panel. Before I start with the findings, I'm just going to give a couple of background notes. One is that what I'm mostly presenting today is something that we did after the elections, as Tamara pointed out, really fresh, just as a follow-up to ask some questions, even though I'd done another poll just 2 weeks before the elections. And those of you who know my work, I've been tracking this issue for a quarter century, so this is not new. So some of the questions I have, we've asked many times before. We're going to look at some of the more recent comparisons to see how things have shifted. I also want to say that this current poll is also part of a bigger project that I have at the University of Maryland now called the Critical Issues Poll, the University of Maryland Critical Issues Poll. I'm directing this project. And what we did in the post-election were questions not only related to foreign policy, but also analyzing our election, which we're going to release a little bit later on. One of the things that we have discovered, particularly over the past 3 years, those of you who've come and attended our events or have followed the results, one of the fascinating changes that have taken place in American politics on the Arab-Israel issue, the Palestinian-Israel issue particularly, is the increased polarization in American politics. That I had written about 3 years ago, and I said this is going to impact the primaries in this season. I'm going to talk about that a little bit. And that what we have seen is during the election year, the polarization only increased on this issue as on many other issues, but on issues related to the Middle East, whether it's the Arab-Israeli conflict, the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, I should say, because that's what we really probe, or attitudes toward Islam and Muslims, the polarization, particularly between Republicans and Democrats on these issues, is greater than almost any other issue, including abortion and gun control. We have often like 50 percentage points and more separating Republicans and Democrats, and you'll see that here as well. So let me start with just to put this in the context of other issues. Now, we know that at some level, the Palestinian-Israeli conflict is hardly the burning issue of the day. Not even in the Middle East is it the burning issue of the day. Everybody's preoccupied with what's happening there, and certainly here, the American public, at some level, does not rank it very high. And so I want to start with that a little bit. By the way, the methodology, just to say something about it, both the October poll and the November poll, these are all done, they're national representative samples done with Nielsen Scarborough. So all of the comparison, actually, that I'm doing over the past few years have been done with Nielsen Scarborough, and the samples are pretty large. The October one was, I believe, over 1,500, and the one after the election was over 1,000. So we have pretty significant size samples. One of the questions we asked, just to start with broadly, is to see how Americans rank global priorities. And here we give them a set of issues that have been ranked high in the discourse, and try to compare them with issues related to the Middle East to see where this particular issue, the Arab-Israeli conflict broadly, or the Palestinian-Israeli conflict specifically, rank on the public's priorities. And the question we typically ask is, what are the two top issues? Not one, but two. We ask them to select two, because most people have one immediately in their mind. They have to struggle for the second. It gives us a little bit more of an indication. And so we have this list that we provide to them. And you could see, not surprisingly, this is very similar to what we have found in the past couple of years, is that ISIS certainly is the number one priority for the public, whether, forget the objective analysis of interest. The public perceives it to be number one. And we've seen that this issue has really kind of even defined American attitudes on a number of other issues, including what they want done in Syria, which is really to even join the Russians to against ISIS because they see it as such a priority issue. Immigration policy, trade deficit, North Korea. But you see that the Palestinian-Israeli conflict is not one of the top two for many people, only 4%. Doesn't mean it's not important. It means it's not one of the top two for most people. It's certainly there with the Iran issue, below a number of other global priorities. But when you ask generally Americans about their sense of how the issue ranks in their own priorities directly, not in comparison to other issues, a lot of Americans think it's really important to them. And so when you ask, is it the single most important issue? Is it in the top three? Is it in the top five? It's not in the top five. Those who say it's not in the top five issues to them are a minority. And you can see that 18%, the black line, is the total. You can see that 18% rank it on the top three, and another 3% rank it as the single most important issue. So nearly, you know, over 20% rank it in the top three. So you have the priorities. People think it's important to them, even though when you ask them to compare it with other issues, it drops, but they think it's important to them. I want to talk about this for a minute because I think what we have missed in this election year, perhaps because of so many issues that we talked about, is that in the primaries, the Palestinian-Israeli issue was an issue for Democrats within the Democratic parties, the Democratic Party, and for Republicans within the Republican Party in ways that we didn't anticipate, given how low it ranks among the other priorities. For example, if you look at the Democratic debates, you know, Bernie Sanders certainly pushed the leading candidate, the winner, ultimate winner, Hillary Clinton, on the fact that she, in his view, was not projecting enough empathy with the Palestinians, in large part because his constituency was much more sympathetic with his position than hers. And there was at least his projected position. You know, objectively, we can talk about that, but certainly the sense that he was closer to the constituency than she was, and that became an issue to the point that he even used it in the debate, and to the point that Hillary Clinton's campaign didn't use the Israel issue much in the public appearances. So it was an issue, therefore, within the Democratic Party. On the Republican side, it was very much an issue. I dare you to look at any of the Republican presidential debates when the issue of Israel wasn't prominent, where Israel wasn't mentioned more than any other issue, where the Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, was not invoked by one candidate or the other, in large part because when I asked in an open question, and I'll show you this again, when I asked in the spring, two polls in the spring asked, name the leader that you admire most, national or international, in the world, open question, before I ask any question about the Arab-Israeli issue, unprompted, Republicans named Benjamin Netanyahu as the single most admired leader, even ahead of Ronald Reagan. And so we had this polarization that played into the hands of different constituencies. So within the Democratic Party, this issue was important. Within the Republican Party, this was even more important. And then when we moved into the general election, well, it wasn't that important anymore because everybody's trying to reach constituents outside of their own parties. And so it became less significant in the general election. But so I want to point out that despite the fact that it's not ranked highly, it is part and parcel of American politics for a variety of reasons. It's important for Republicans, and our polls showed this throughout the last few years, in large part because of evangelical Christians who are very, very much interested in Israel. They rank it higher in their priorities, and they want to take a pro-Israel view. And if you take the evangelicals out of the Republican Party, the Republican Party starts looking like the rest of America on this issue. And I've written an article on that. Now, on the Democratic side, while it is not so much that it has a major constituency in terms of ethnic groups or religious group, it has become a paradigm or a prototype for the liberal, egalitarian human rights, equality, international law, cosmopolitan constituency of the Democratic Party, which is the core of the Democratic Party. It's become a symbol of something broader than itself, and therefore it's invoked as an issue that matters to the philosophy and the ideology of much of the Democratic Party. So, therefore, it does have importance in American politics in ways that are not always visible if you just look at ranking. Now, I want to go through some of the questions. The first couple of questions that I want to review are ones that we're tracking, ones that we've been asking over the past couple of years to see how Americans feel about them and to see whether there's change at all in the American public's position. One question has been, this is certainly before the election, we've asked this in 2014, 2015, is what if there is a UN resolution on the establishment of Palestinian state, should the U.S. Vote for it, against it, or abstain? So we've tracked that question. We asked it again in October, just before the elections, and in November as well. And so what you find here is that in general, only about 34%, 31% of the American public, the middle, look at the black line for totals, 31% of the American public want a resolution like that vetoed at the UN. 34% suggest that we vote for such a resolution, and 32% suggest that we abstain. Now, again, look at the division, of course, along party lines. 51% of Republicans want a resolution vetoed, and 51% of Democrats want the U.S. to actually endorse a resolution, not just abstain. So, you know, quite the opposite of each other. And this has been not so different, actually, from, let's say, November 2015. There's a little bit of difference, but not a huge one. I mean, this is a kind of a long list here, broken by party and total. But you can see that the trend pretty much holds, but during the election year, it clearly the polarization increased. You can see that more of the Republicans now want to vote against. Only 43% wanted to vote against at 215, and more of the Democrats now want to vote in favor. So the polarization increased during the election year, undoubtedly. We've seen that happen. Now, it's also, you know, when you look at the age differentiation, clearly the 18 to 34, the younger people, fewer of them want to veto the resolution, only a quarter. And again, that's a trend that holds pretty much on all issues. The second issue that we, let me actually go to the Trump administration issue directly here. So after the election, we asked this question about what they want the Trump administration to do in mediating the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I want to also mention here that historically, really for a quarter century on this, in fact, a little bit longer than quarter century, I've asked a question of whether the American public wanted the U.S. to lean toward Israel, to lean toward the Palestinians, or to lean toward neither side. And historically, we found very, very common trend, which is majorities, often two-thirds, want the U.S. to lean toward neither side, but on those who want to take one side or the other, overwhelmingly people want to take Israel's side. That used to be much more bipartisan, and as I said, more in recent years it's become far more partisan in the division. So this was specific to Trump. So if Trump now is elected, this is after the election, asking them, what do you want Trump to do? And so here we find a similar trend. So look at the bottom category. Again, look at the black line. 57% of all Americans want the U.S. to lean toward neither side. But look at the numbers for 69% of Democrats want the U.S. to lean toward neither side, and only 42% of Republicans want to lean toward neither side. Also interesting among the Democrats, I want you to look at the lean toward one side or the other. 17% say lean toward Israel, and 11% say lean toward the Palestinians. That's not such a huge difference in historical perspective, particularly when you consider the margin of error. It's getting much closer than we have seen in the past. That's what they wish would happen, okay? But we followed up with it, and by the way, here again, if you look at the age division, younger people want to take, more people want to the U.S. to lean toward neither side. But we followed this question up with a question of what do you believe Trump will actually do on this issue as opposed to what you want him to do? And here we have 57% say they think he's going to lean toward Israel. So they were, you know, just exactly 57% of the total. And interestingly, this is one issue in which Republicans and Democrats agree. 62% of Republicans and 55% of Democrats think he's actually going to lean toward Israel if he engages in mediation. So there is the realism that is reflected here. Now, the next question we've been tracking, particularly over the past 3 years, on Israeli settlements, particularly when we started when the administration was calling for action on settlements. And we had tracked to see the extent to which the public, wanted the U.S. to act on settlements. So we give them a few choices. One choice is do nothing, limit your opposition to words, impose sanctions, or take more serious action. And historically, I'll show you the historical trend in a minute, but look at the numbers. Overall, what we find is 46% of the total now support imposing sanctions or taking more serious action. I'll show you that that's an increase from 2015. I'll show you that data in a minute. But look at the partisan divide. Now we have 60% of Democrats. A majority of Democrats, 60%, support imposing sanctions, taking more serious action, versus 68% of Republicans who want to do nothing or limit American action to words. And if you compare them over 3 years, this is a three-year trend overall. From 2014, 2015, 2016, this is actually the same event every single year for the past 3 years. What you can see the changes here what happened with the American public. The bottom line about the sanctions or more serious measures went from 38% in 2014, stayed roughly the same in 2015, and then expanded during the election year to 46% overall. And across the Democrats, you could see that Democrats particularly, the category, it went from 48% in 2014, 49% 2015, to 60%. And by the way, this also was a trend. We also did a poll, I'm not showing it here, in October on this, that showed it up going to the mid-50s. So it was like incremental change. But a huge polarization taking place. Not much has happened on Republicans, by the way. You could see that Republican position, they remained adamantly opposed to taking anything more than words, 66% to 68%. Younger people are more favoring taking action than older people. Okay, so I want to just focus a little bit on something a little bit different, which is to the extent that there is a really relevant immediate policy question on the table right now, it is whether Obama is going to do anything in the transition. I mean, that's really to the extent that this is a policy issue at all, is will Obama do something before he leaves office on this issue? And so we ask a question, and I want to just clarify, how we did it, because it's very important to understand that we know the public hasn't necessarily heard all these things, so we wanted to put arguments for and against. So the question here is about whether Obama should act in that transition, essentially preempting an incoming president on this issue. So we told the public that the administration is considering such action. It's reported that it's considering such action, either on the issue of declaring parameters on a final settlement or on settlements, to end the settlements, or taking a resolution against the settlements, or perhaps declaring them illegal or something of that sort. And then we presented them with two arguments, one for and one against Obama acting before he leaves office. So we wanted to let them know, what the argument against it would be and see whether they agree or disagree with it, and then put an argument for and do the same, then follow up with the specific policy question. So the first statement we put to them, it's wrong for Obama to act on such an important issue during the transition. The decision on this issue should be left to the President Trump to deal with, and so forth. So we put that full argument that you can see there before them, and we asked them to say whether they agreed or disagreed with it, how much they agreed or disagreed with it. And so we found that a plurality agreed with this position. 46% said they agreed or strongly agreed or somewhat agreed with the fact that it's wrong for Obama to act. Now, look at the division. 73% of Republicans, of course, compared to 21% of Democrats, agreed with this. It's a 51% difference. Again, not surprising. Now, we followed up with a separate argument, which is One reason the U.S. has been ineffective in addressing the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is that American presidents face domestic political constraints in Congress, campaign contributions, and lobbies. Presidents have an opportunity to act effectively to advance the national interest during presidential transitions. And so whether or not they agreed with that position as a support position, we find exactly the same numbers reversed between Democrats and Republicans. 45% say, plurality say they agree with that statement. But here we have 71% of Democrats agreeing, 20% of Republicans agreeing. The exact reverse of this argument. So now that they've heard two arguments, one for and one against, so that they, you know, this is similar to the debate that they hear in public, then we go and say, okay, you've heard the arguments, you've decided on whether you agree or disagreed with them. Now, what would you do? Would you support UN action on parameters? Would you support UN action on settlements? Or the Obama taking advancing or supporting a resolution on this issue? So the first one is President Obama's support or sponsorship for a United Nations resolution that outlines the parameters for ending the Israeli-Palestinian conflict before he leaves office. And so here's what we find. We find that 46%, look at the bottom category, a plurality, 46% say they support or strongly support such action. You find that only 27% say they oppose or strongly oppose such action. And obviously another 25% neither oppose nor support. Again, not surprisingly, partisan divide. Among those who support, 70% are Democrats, only 22% are Republican. And when you ask them whether President Obama, whether they support or not sponsorship for a UN resolution to end Israeli settlement construction in the West Bank before he leaves office, then you again find a plurality. Look at the bottom, the black line, 40% support it. You find 33%, the top category, the black line, 33% oppose it, and 23% neither support nor oppose. More support than opposition for both, but again, broken down along party lines, 65% of Democrats support, 16% of Republicans only support. Okay, now this is the first time I asked this question, which is, I wanted to test the argument of that we have in the debate whether Israel is an asset or a liability strategically. So I gave both options to them. And remember, some people can agree with both. It's just, as you could see from the first categories, it's like people are divided. And then you have to force them, okay, I know you're all over the place, but tell me, if you had to act, what would you do? And that's the way we do it, so because we want to be able to vet these ideas out in the public and to have them think about them out loud. Or at least in their head, not out loud, and tell us what they think. And so here we presented whether they agree or disagree with this statement: Israel is an important ally to the United States as it provides essential military intelligence cooperation and plays a regional role that's helpful to American interest. We found that a majority agree with this statement. You have 76%. Actually, there is really very little variation across party line on this one. In fact, I would say I was a bit surprised how much harmony there is on this one. I mean, of course, there's some variation. More Republicans agree with it than Democrats and independents, but still, quite a large number. Now, the second proposition is Israel is a burden to the U.S., as Israel's actions in the region generate hostility toward the United States and Arab and Muslim-majority countries. And so we presented that to see whether they agree or disagree with that. And what we found is that 54% disagree, 40% agree overall. But again, look at the Democrats. 55% agree that Israel is a burden, and 39% disagree. So there is quite a big difference between Democrats and Republicans on this way at all. Now, keep in mind, they're saying it's both strategic asset and a liability, because they've already agreed that they think it's an asset. And now they're saying it's also a liability. So they think it's both. But they think it's more of an asset than a liability based on the numbers. How much influence do you believe the Israeli government has in American politics and policies? Now, we started that, if you recall, with the Iran issue, when that was hotly debated about, you know, this issue. So we tried to track it and see how it's shifting over time, whether after the Iran issue this thing would recede a little bit or what would happen in the conversation. So here's what we found. We have 15% say too little influence, 39% say too much influence, and 44% say about the right level of influence. Now, again, though, look at Democrats. 55% say it has too much influence versus only 9% who say it too little influence. So you can see that issue quite polarized as well. We have a comparison from November 2015-2016. The numbers haven't significantly changed overall. In terms of the totals, you can see that it's roughly the same. Too much influence just increased within, really the changes are all within the margin of error, but the main change happened between Republicans and Democrats, where more Democrats now believe it has too much influence and fewer Republicans think it has too much influence. So what happened in the campaign is really increased polarization even on this issue during that election year. Final question, which has nothing to do with these issues specifically. I've mentioned it already in my introduction, but I will go back to it a little bit. Because in the polling that I do generally, I have these broad questions that are not related necessarily to the Middle East about sort of worldview. And one of them is name the world or national leader that you admire most, an open-ended question. They can write whatever they want, and then we tabulate it to see who they think. And we ask that up front so that we don't have them biased by the questions that come next, so we don't prompt them, so they haven't heard these names that are going to follow afterwards. So we do it right up front with the early questions. And so we've been doing that. We did that again in October, just 2 weeks before the election. This is not after the election. This was done just 2 weeks before the election. So we asked that question again. And as I told you, one of the surprises last year was that Netanyahu was the number one for Republicans, even ahead of Ronald Reagan in two polls, not just one. And here's the new results. So Netanyahu is still high among Republicans, and he's still number two. Ronald Reagan now is ahead of him. For Democrats, of course, he doesn't show up at all. In fact, you know, Democrats arguably have a more negative view of him than positive view. But obviously it's like two different worlds here when you look at this. Republicans and Democrats tells you where people are. And I have questions about whom the leaders they dislike. It's even more of a two worlds on that issue. But you could see that he's still up there among Republicans. I think he dropped a bit, in part because of what happened in primaries versus the general election. In the primaries, he was invoked almost in every single, Republican debate. After the primaries went to the general election, that was hardly done. And so I think his name wasn't quite out there in the same way as before, and I think, therefore, he dropped a little bit. So let me end with that and invite my colleagues to join me on the stage. Thank you very much.
And folks, just an update. Unfortunately, Karen DeYoung had an emergency this morning and is not joining us. But fortunately, I've drafted an expert. And delighted to have Martin Indyk join us for this conversation. Hard to do better. And it'll just take us a minute to get wired up here. Okay. So thanks to all of you. And Martin, thank you for being willing to be put on the spot. Sarah, let me start with you. And of course, you've been thinking and writing for the last few months, really, since the conventions, about how President Obama is going to weigh his options in this final period of a two-term presidency, during which he worked intensively, not once but twice, to try and move negotiations forward to resolve this conflict, stymied both times. And you wrote in a piece for our Marcaz blog after the election that anything Obama would do now would be symbolic at best, but that there still might be reasons to do it and also reasons not to do it. So when I look at this poll data, correct me if I'm wrong here, Shibley, it seems that this is a pretty permissive environment for President Obama to go to the UN or to lay out parameters in some other form. Sarah, why wouldn't he do it?
Sure. Well, I think the poll data is very instructive. On the one hand, he has the political cover right now, and I think we see this more than ever, that should Obama move forward, this is the great time to do it. And also, it may be the only time to do it. And I think that's one of the real takeaways from this data, is the tremendous polarization, showing that there will not be pressure from the Republican Party, from the party of the White House and the Congress, to move forward on this issue. So if Obama actually wants to do something, this is the time. However, there's still tremendous risk. I mean, one is things I've laid out in the past about legacy issues, that, first of all, it serves to kind of highlight a failure, and it could go down as again, another sort of nail in the coffin of this issue. But another flip side of this, I think, is that if we want to look at this more sort of substantively, assuming that President Obama does actually care about this issue, which I think he does, it might actually behoove him to not move, in that he could keep the progress made in his pocket and hand that to the Trump administration. And that would actually, I think, help them the most. I'm not sure he's going to be that altruistic, but that's one path he could take.
Okay, and presumably if he were to take that path, that would be having made some evaluation that President-elect Trump would be interested
exactly.
in pursuing a negotiated solution. Now, we've heard quite divergent things, both from the President-elect and from a number of his advisors over the months of the campaign and since the election on this issue. On the one hand, he said, as he said to the New York Times last week, that this is the biggest deal of all, and he'd love to do it. He's a deal maker. On the other hand, we've heard him say he's going to be the most pro-Israel president ever in a way that at least many of his voting constituencies seem to interpret as support for the Netanyahu government's positions on the issue, and his Israel advisor, both of his Israel advisors, Jonathan Greenblatt and David Friedman, have been quoted saying that he's going to move the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem right away and that he sees no problem with continued settlement activity. All of these, Martin, are issues that you have confronted in the Clinton administration. And this question of what once the Kerry effort in which you were involved reached its conclusion, whether to lay out the results of that process in some form, like parameters, that's a calculation you've also been a part of, again, at the end of the Clinton administration and more recently. So with that experience under your belt, how would you weigh these decisions?
Well, first of all, thank you for the opportunity, unexpected as it is. In the case of President Obama's choices here, I think what's weighing most in his mind is this principle of passing the baton on in a careful and positive, constructive way.
They keep saying responsible transition.
Responsible. That was
yes.
the word I was looking for.
Responsible transition.
Responsible. So he wants to appear responsible, and I suspect he may think that introducing the resolution in the terms that Shibley has asked in his polling would not fit in that category of responsible actions, since it would come during the transition when he is in effect a lame duck. I think that what Shibley didn't poll exactly, and because it didn't seem relevant at the time, but could now become relevant, is that you could have a sequence of events. The Israeli Knesset on Monday is going to vote on the first reading of a bill to legalize settlement outposts that are illegal under Israeli law, some 50 of them, many of them built on Palestinian private land, which also makes them illegal in international law. And that looks like it will prompt the introduction of a Security Council resolution, which the Palestinians have been putting forward for some time, but held off before the elections on pushing it, which would, in some form of words or another, declare settlements illegal. And that's not something that Obama introduces, but suddenly has to take a decision on as to what the U.S. will do. And if it is language that reflects or actually quotes U.S. positions on this, opposed to settlement activity, which have become quite strident as the settlement activity has increased, then he may just say it's the responsible thing to do to abstain and let it go forward, or even vote for it.
Though that would be a departure from the recent track record of U.S. policy on these U.N. resolutions.
Correct. But it would be a departure, whereas an abstention on the grounds that it represents U.S. policy, no change from, but U.S. policy in an environment in which right-wing actors in Israel are pushing in such a very determined way against U.S. policy. You know, I think that puts him in a more difficult quandary in terms of what he would do in that case. As for President-elect Trump, you've reviewed what so far we know. I think the most important thing is that each he's now brought it up three times, unprompted, that this is the ultimate deal, the Israeli-Palestinian deal, that everybody tells him, especially businessmen whom he respects, Israeli businessmen, that it can't be done. And that just seems to egg him on and make him feel that this is, after all his advisors told him he couldn't become president. So therefore, I think in terms of his intentions, it tells you something. And I would not dismiss as just some throwaway line that he said that he would make his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, the envoy in this regard. I actually take that quite seriously. I think that is an indication of intention. So how is he going to balance this apparent desire to be the peacemaker between the Israelis and the Palestinians on the one hand, and his commitment to move the embassy to Jerusalem on the other, which will immediately rule out the possibility that he could be a mediator between Israelis and Palestinians, having taken such a strong pro-Israel decision on the most sensitive issue that divides Israelis and Palestinians, the issue of Jerusalem. So I think there he's going to be in a dilemma. Previous presidents, I've seen this up front, up close.
Being Bill Clinton.
Bill Clinton. Mm-hmm. We had him say it in the New York primaries. And fortunately, he was in a situation where he could say that the parties have agreed to negotiate it as a final status issue as part of the Oslo Accords, which came 9 months after he entered office. So he said, well, I'm not going to move it now because it would undermine the negotiation. So that became his position. George W. Bush was much more blatant about it. He promised it. And when he came into office, one of the first meetings he had was on the Middle East. I wasn't there, but I was still his ambassador in Israel. But I'm told reliably that they brought it up, said, what should we do, Mr. President? He says, oh, God, we're not going to do that. And that was the end of that. If President Trump, once he gets into office, decides that he wants to prioritize making peace, then he's got an explanation. He said, look, I want to make peace. I don't want to jeopardize that. So we're going to wait until we've tried to resolve this issue. But if he wants to really kind of create a crisis in order to take advantage of it, that might be another way in which he does things, something I wrote about today. You can see it on the Brookings website. He can create a crisis over Jerusalem by moving the embassy and then jumpstart negotiations on it to kind of
on the back of a crisis.
Yeah, on the back of a crisis.
Okay, that's creative diplomacy. I will come back to you in just a minute, Sarah, but I want to, jumping off from this question of President Trump's stark choice, Shibley, it seemed to me that the data you have here reflects that he's, whichever path he takes, choosing to pursue conflict resolution or choosing to follow some of the things that we've heard from his advisors, he will have some constituency in the American public. But the mainstream is in one place, in favor of neutrality, in favor of conflict resolution. The Republican constituency, and particularly evangelicals, whom he courted assiduously, are in a very different place. Mm-hmm. So how do you evaluate the political choice he faces?
Well, first of all, on before I talk about Trump, let me just address Obama a little bit, because I think there is real incentives for him to act, I agree with all the reservations, but I think there are two issues in my own view. One has to do with his immediate constituents, the Democrats. As you can see, it's not just that the environment is permissive. Democrats very much want him to do so. I mean, Democrats are on the side of we want him to do something. And they have become even more so after the election because they're fearful that Trump is going to ruin it. And so the Democrats are really behind him on this. They want him to do something. And the second is the legacy issue. I think Sarah pointed to some reservations I agree with. But I think he also has a legacy question to address here. This is if you recall, Martin would remember, in 8 years ago, when Brookings and the CFR put forth the recommendations for what to do, it was said, at least in an article I wrote, co-authored for that project, that if this is not going to happen on his clock, it's not likely to happen at all, because of where we were in terms of the time. If you're going to preserve the two-state solution, if it doesn't happen in the next 8 years, I'm not sure when it's going to happen at all. And so he has, in essence, he came in believing that. He immediately appointed a special envoy. He failed throughout the whole campaign. And in a way, the 8 years went by reinforcing the status quo with more settlements that he opposed. And therefore, we're actually more distant from a two-state than we were when he started. And so the legacy issue is, will he go down if it turns out that there's no two-state at all? Will he go down as the president who killed it? And I think he has a legacy interest in trying to preserve it if he believes this is where it should go, or that there is even still time to reserve it. I don't know. This is all... Martin was a special envoy, and as we all know, this is an issue that only one man can decide on, and that is the President of the United States. And we don't really know exactly what's in his head on this, but clearly this is probably even important to him personally for a variety of reasons. We've seen that indication. So I wouldn't say that he has no incentive. I think he's struggling with it, and maybe he will deem it to be something that can't work, or maybe there's no way to preserve the two states, and it'll be another failed attempt. But if something comes up on settlements, that is a French resolution or European resolution, and does declare settlements illegal, it's going to be very hard for him in the transition. I mean, he might not want it to come forward and might be able to do diplomacy to stop that from coming forward. But if it does come forward, he's going to have a heck of a time vetoing that resolution. I just can't imagine it. And therefore, and I think given where the Democrats are. So I don't mm-hmm. rule it off. I know where people have been writing on this. I don't know what's in his head.
Okay, but this is an interesting point, that there's actually a Democratic Party politics incentive in addition to
a legacy incentive.
Yeah.
So now on Trump... I think, look, I don't know if there's someone who knows, a magician who knows what he's going to do. I mean, or that he cares about public opinion. He's proved this wrong because we had all these public opinion polls early on. And then he trumped public opinion. Sorry, that wasn't intended. Here's the problem in anticipating with him. Normally, he's not the first president who comes in with no foreign policy experience. I mean, Bill Clinton was like that. George W. Bush was like that. In some ways, he's actually more connected internationally than Bill Clinton was when he was first elected as president. So that wasn't the issue, because normally when you have presidents like that, you have a set of advisors. You know who they are. I mean, you know, this is the part of a party establishment, the part of a foreign policy establishment. They appoint people, you know, more or less they're going to guide him and her or her, if had it been Clinton. And you have a sense of where likely to go, knowing that the president is not going to have in this particular case, we really don't. I mean, the people that he has around who have not been really part of the establishment are not experts. They've been more to the right on this issue, more on the Netanyahu side of the issue more often than not. But we don't have a cluster of people. We don't know who's going to run policy. And also, every indication from the way he ran the campaign and he's run the appointment so far is it seems to be he disregards assistance anyway. He makes up his own mind. He seems to disregard most advice. And he's been all over the map on this issue. He's taken a pro-Israel position, but early on he started by saying he wanted to be even-handed. He made a couple of other statements that are indicative of some other position. So I'm not in a position to predict, except for the fact that he seems to care a lot about public opinion. Even though he's been able to guide it, this is something that he engages. And does he care about public opinion mostly over his core constituency? His core constituency is very complicated. Yes, the evangelicals are on one side of this issue. And I think, principally, he gained their support because he projected himself to be a winner. They wanted a winner rather than a loser. I did some focus groups on that. As you know, I'm writing a book on the evangelicals. But mostly because he promised them tax relief for religious schools. That's the main thing. And look at the one he appointed to be education minister in favor of vouchers to religious school, the first thing he does. This is their issue. Yes, Israel is important to them, but he's not going to lose them over the issue of Israel.
That's a very good point. Okay, Sarah, you wanted to get in on this.
Yeah, two quick points. One is on the issue of whether or not we would abstain, the United States would abstain in the UN. And I think a signal for this is to look at the statements that have come out of the State Department. And even prior to the election, you started to see harsher language. The statements on settlements, the statements on some of the issues, the actions Israel was taking, the language was harsher than it had been in the past. And I think that that's important. A lot of the policy is made from the podium, as they say. And so I think, you know, that's where you might see a sort of slight encroachment towards the idea where we wouldn't necessarily abstain in the UN.
And of course, having made these somewhat harsher characterizations of settlement activity, if the U.S. did then veto a U.N. Security Council resolution, the Obama administration would end looking pretty hypocritical on this issue.
Exactly. And then the other point is on Shibley's point about legacy. And, you know, I do buy the argument that Obama could end up going down in history as the person who sort of killed the two-state solution. But I think the calculation he has to be making is any action worth it? Is it going to actually do anything? Mm-hmm. And this is where I'm just not sure he's going to decide that it's worth the effort, that it's worth the blowback potentially from other states around the globe. I think, you know, if he's going to do something, he has to actually believe that his action is going to sort of negate that pushback on his legacy.
Mm-hmm. Okay. There are a bunch of other fascinating issues in the poll, and particularly one you got to toward the end, which is where there is much more consensus and less polarization in the American public about the value of Israel as an ally or a strategic asset to the United States. I would like to talk about that if we can in the discussion, but I want to give a chance to all of you to ask some questions as well. So at this point, let me open it up. I'm going to ask you to wait for the mic, tell us your name, and please, because we're fairly short on time, ask one short, sharp question. And we're going to start up here in the front. We'll work our way to the back right here.
Charles Brosman. Let us suppose that either a resolution is approved by Mr. Obama or that the United States does not vote on it, abstains. Then Trump comes in and his people. Would they now not do everything in their power to negate what's already been done by the UN?
Well, first of all, it depends on what the resolution is. Let's say if it's a settlement resolution, let's just say it's a resolution to declare settlements illegal, an extreme case that probably unlikely, but let's assume it's that. Now, how is the U.S. going to undo that at the UN? Because it's going to need UN support, Security Council resolution support to negate it, and it's not likely the international community has been supportive of the U.S. The problem for the international community has been the U.S. would veto such a resolution. It's not likely if President Trump is going to be able to mobilize support. So the question is, so the resolution, in my opinion, is hard to change. It's not impossible, but it's just not likely. And so the question is, yeah, he can disregard it, but what are the implications for the international community where people will start making legal cases against settlement activities? In various courts or actions or people who might become very uncomfortable doing something, banks or other institutions dealing, including American ones, dealing with it given that it's a Security Council resolution. So that's the thinking, obviously, whether it will work that way. That I don't think a President Trump can reverse. I mean, he can decide on policy issues, but once it's a UN Security Council resolution, I don't think he's going to be in a position to reverse it.
But he can reverse U.S. policy.
Yeah,
yes.
He can, for
because,
sure.
Because over the years, presidents have played with different adjectives. It was originally illegal under Jimmy Carter.
Settlements
were illegal. Under Ronald Reagan, they became unhelpful. I think under Clinton, they were unhelpful, too.
They were also illegitimate. Yeah.
No, illegitimate became was Obama's word. So, you know, Trump could turn it to helpful. that would have the effect on the ground, and I think that's the most important point. Up to now, and Natan Sachs, who's in the audience here, has written a very good piece about this. Up to now, Prime Minister Netanyahu was able to argue to his right-wing deep settler state people, look, just take it easy, hold back. You know, we cannot afford to have the United States join the international community in condemning this and isolating us. You know, so he used it as a constraint on the settlers. If Trump now says, you know, they're not unhelpful, they're just fine, they're not an obstacle, then the right wing, which already has taken a move during this transition by trying to pass the legislation to legalize the outposts, then there's no holding them back. And the push to annex 60% of the West Bank, which is their ultimate agenda, I think will be brought forward quite dramatically.
Thank you. I think it's worth noting that Netanyahu then would lose the excuse of American constraints in talking to his own right wing. And it's also worth noting that the vote that is coming up next week on legalizing these outposts is one, it's a bill that I believe the Prime Minister opposes, right? So he's facing down
elements. Well, he opposed it, but now he's going to vote for it, so.
Okay.
Depends what day of the week.
It depends what day of the week. So maybe these two leaders have something in common there. All right. Moving on down to Gary Mitchell. Yep.
Thanks very much, Garrett Mitchell. I write the Mitchell Report. And Shibley, I want to ask a question that that doesn't come specifically out of this poll, but over the long haul that you've been doing this, where you've been measuring attitudes in Israel and Palestine and then measuring attitudes in the United States, you know, between Republicans and Democrats, et cetera, I want to ask a question that should be will seem it on the surface to be very obvious, but I don't mean it quite so obviously, and that is, given the disparity, whatever other word you might want to use to describe the nature of the relationship between Israelis and Palestinians and the relationship between Republicans and Democrats, if you were assigned the job to moderate one group, Israelis and Palestinians, Republicans, Democrats. Which would you choose and why?
Okay, I'm going to give you a minute to think about that, and let's take a couple more if we can. The gentleman in the gray sweater there.
Thank you. Professor Talhami,
if you could introduce yourself.
Oh, sorry. Fahad Abouras from the University of Maryland. The cornerstone of U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East in the last half century was the relationship with Saudi Arabia and Israel. Now, we have seen since 9/11, in public opinion at least, there's a radical shift towards Saudi Arabia. And we've seen in your poll and from other polls that there's a relative and very small, but nonetheless relative and significant, in my opinion, shift in public opinion regarding Israel, especially among young Democrats or young liberals. Now, do you think that could affect, especially that you said that President Trump is very interested in polls and that's something he cares about greatly? Do you think that's something that could affect his policy, or do you think that the partisan gap, as you showed it today, is just so big and so skewed towards Republicans that as a Republican president, he'll have to take into consideration what his group wants?
Okay, so a question about interest group politics. Yeah.
Let me go backwards. I'll start with Thayer's question. I think what's interesting about the change in American public opinion is not just that it is partisanship between Democrats and Republicans increased over this. It is that the expanding groups in America have actually become more and more even-handed. So it's not just Democratic Party. You can look at the aggregate numbers where, you know, for example, the number of people who want to sanctions imposed has increased overall by some significant amount from something like 37% to 46% or 38% to 46%. Beyond the Democratic constituency. A lot of that does come from the intensity of Democrats, but when you look at the actual demographics, what do we find? Hispanics want the U.S. to be more even-handed than the rest of the population, African-Americans, millennials, women. So those demographics are moving in one direction. That's the change that has taken place over the long haul, and that takes a time before it becomes really part of American politics in a serious way beyond party politics, because most of these constituents for now are clustered in the Democratic Party, some outside, but obviously clustered there. So I don't think in the short term that's going to impact Trump's deliberation, particularly when you take into account what I showed you up front. This is not a high priority issue for Americans. I mean, let's keep that in mind. They think it's important to them personally, but when if he's going to tell them that's the way we fight ISIS, or that's the way we do trade, or that's the way we do immigration, or that, you know, those issues are going to trump this any day of the week. And so I personally don't think he's going to be impacted a lot by it. The second question, I know it's not a simple question, Gary, but I would say that I certainly wouldn't want to do either right now. I think that the paradox of this is that, you know, if there's a will to negotiate the Israel-Palestine question, we see that majorities actually are closer to a solution. The barrier is, of course, there are differences, but the barriers are more political will barriers than they are about agreement on the shape of an outcome. We see that in the polling. Whereas with Democrats and Republicans, they have two different worldviews. It has become, it's not just a partisan political issue. I mean, you look at every way. Who are the heroes for Republicans? Who are the heroes for Democrats? Who are the villains for Republicans? Who are the villains for Democrats? You know, what are the priorities for each? What is worldview on the most contentious issues of the day? They are night and day. And so I think it's actually a deeper divide in some ways here.
Wow, so you'd rather negotiate the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
I didn't say quite that.
You heard it here first. I do want to pick up on something you said, Shibley, which is that, you know, it's funny when we, in our public discussion, our media discussion about Israel and about the Middle East, it often focuses on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. But of course, that's not the only thing going on in the Middle East. And the poll data reflects that ISIS is the core concern and certainly drove a lot of the election campaign on foreign policy to the extent we talked about foreign policy. Sarah, from your seat, you were in the Israeli-Palestinian Affairs Office at State and the Policy Planning Office at State. How did the data strike you showing, you know, this trend around opinion on the conflict on the one hand, But 76% of Americans, young people, old people, Democrats, Republicans, think that Israel is a strategic asset to the United States. So what did you see as the balance in your work between working the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and working that broader set of issues?
Sure. You know, I think it's one thing, you know, the Israeli-Palestinian, first of all, just sort of the logistics of the State Department itself, and this is very superficial, but it's symbolic in that the office of Israel-Palestinian Affairs, where Martin's office was attached to our office, is right
there. You were attached to our office.
Yes. but, you know, it's front and center. It's right across the hall from the Assistant Secretary for Near Eastern Affairs office, and that's by design. You also have that office is staffed up more than any other office. You know, I think we're actually less busy than anyone else because we had so many people working our issues. And I say that because
Syria's blowing up,
right,
Egypt's blowing up.
We're twiddling our thumbs, even on a busy day, because we have so much staff. And that's partially because this is such an important symbolic issue to our foreign policy and to the American public. But that sort of superficiality aside, I think, you know, every piece of U.S. foreign policy touches or is impacted by the Israeli-Palestinian issue and by U.S.-Israel relations. And I think, you know, we had to weigh in on issues that other desks wouldn't have necessarily had to weigh in on or had the opportunity to weigh in on. But at the same time, you know, it is also very segregated and very stovepiped. And it'll be interesting to see if this administration continues to place an emphasis on this. And also, how do you marry that with trying to negotiate as a neutral arbiter? And I think that's another interesting thing from the data is sort of looking at, there's still clearly an emphasis towards Israel, but also a desire to solve this thing, and you can't really be seen as more pro-Israel and also neutral at the same time, and that'll be a challenge this and all administrations have to face.
Thank you. Is there a mic in the back? Yes, we have a mic in the back. Okay, so there is a question right in front of you. I'm just trying to be even-handed front and back, and yes, people in the middle also, Saeed. Go ahead.
Thank you. I'm Ori Mir with Americans for Peace Now. Shibli, you mentioned that there's also a discrepancy not only along partisan lines, but also along age lines and so on. So I wanted to ask you, where does it play out the most in terms of age? And if you can talk about other breakdowns where you saw that there were differences between various types of demographics.
Thank you. And before you answer that, let's just take one more on the aisle here from Saeed right in the middle.
Thank you. My name is Saeed Erekat. I'm a Palestinian journalist. My question to Martin Indyk, with the two-state solution virtually dead, or, you know, on life support, what kind of future dynamics, Palestinian-Israeli dynamics, do you envision under the one-state reality? Thank you.
Okay. Shibli.
Uri, as I said earlier, and some of the data I displayed, but other polls that I've done over the past year particularly, we actually did the demographic analysis, younger people want the U.S. to be more even-handed. Younger Democrats are almost equally divided between wanting to support Palestinians and Israelis among the minorities who don't want the U.S. to be even-handed. The expanding, you know, the core constituents of the Democratic Party in general, Hispanics, African-Americans, women, tend to be wanting the U.S. more to be even-handed than take Israel's side. They also tend to be more supportive of imposing sanctions on settlements. They tend to be more supportive of a UN resolution on two states. They tend to be less supportive of aid to Israel, or at least to think that what we provide is too high. And, you know, majority think that it's too high, but even bigger majority think it's too high among younger people.
Okay, and Saeed's question, I think, Martin, gets to a point you made at the very beginning, noting that it's Netanyahu's, it's the legislative proposal on the Israeli side that may drive international action. Are things between Israelis and Palestinians on the ground what are going to drive the policy, not things out of Washington?
You know, for many years, American officials have argued, along with Europeans and others, that the status quo between Israelis and Palestinians is not sustainable. But what we've discovered over the years is the status quo is preferable to the alternatives of trying to end the conflict for both sides, either because people don't believe in it, or because the deal of a two-state solution doesn't look attractive enough to either side at this point with so much water under the bridge. Palestinians, I think, are going through a period of internal change that is going to preoccupy them. There's a succession process underway, although you wouldn't know it from Abu Mazen's, President Mahmoud Abbas's endorsement as the leader of Fatah for another 5 years. But nevertheless, there's an election, I think, going to take place in the next couple of days for Fatah, in which there will be a relatively new guard emerging. Many of the Abus that we've come to know and hate or love will be passing from the scene. Hamas, you know, is also going through a process of change, although that seems a little more limited. They are gaining on the West Bank. The process of reconciliation may also gain traction. So I think there's some sorting out to be done on the Palestinian side. And my sense from talking to them very recently is that they're not ready for a new American initiative to try to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict for the time being. On the Israeli side, we see a different dynamic, which I've already described, which is the settlers are going to be going for it even more aggressively than what we've seen in the past. And if added to that is the move of the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem, then I think it's going to kind of ratchet up the tensions quite dramatically. And I don't know how Palestinians will then respond to it. But I do think that if you look at the trend, the disillusionment with the two-state solution on the Palestinian side, combined with a sense that, you know, Washington isn't really serious about it, nobody really cares about it in the Arab world, is likely to give a boost to the trend that we've already seen towards the argument, just give us equal rights in an Israeli state, and we'll settle for that. We can live with that. We'll be happy with that in some ways, preferable to what we have now. And while that's not a solution either, I do think that we're going to see that kind of view gaining greater traction and even prevailing, especially amongst younger people on the Palestinian side who have lived with the reality of Israel. That's all they've ever known.
Okay, let's see if we can get a couple more in right here in front.
Susie Gelman, as chair of the Israel Policy Forum, I certainly hope the two-state solution is not dead, even if it's dormant. I wanted to ask the panel about some of the regional alignments that currently can be taken advantage of. I'm referring specifically to Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Egypt, Gulf states, who are enjoying, at least under the table to some extent, and even above the table out front, cooperation with Israel that's been unprecedented. And your poll, Shibley, showed that the fight against ISIS is number one priority for the people who were polled, so therefore the American public, I assume. These countries are very, very significant in the fight against ISIS, and that is also a fight that Trump certainly declared over and over again during the campaign was one of his main priorities, and we've seen in his nominations to date, or the people he hopes to nominate or appoint, like NSA Mike Flynn, people who are very much in that camp of fighting ISIS. So can you bring this all together in terms of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict? Because these moderate Arab states have made it very clear that solving this conflict in a way that gives the Palestinians a state is their roadblock to moving forward to more robust economic cooperation with Israel and really the regional alliances that have not yet fully flourished.
Okay, so perhaps from an American public perspective, these issues aren't so connected, but in the region, they do seem to be much more intertwined. And we haven't talked at all yet also about the announcement yesterday by President-elect Trump of General Jim Mattis as his nominee for defense secretary, General Mattis has had some pretty stark things to say about the effect he felt on his, when he was commander-in-chief of CENTCOM, of Central Command, the effect he felt of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict on his ability to work with Arab states in the region. So is that maybe something that could drive President Trump's calculations?
I think so in the following way. I mean, I'm not necessarily optimistic about it, but I'll tell you what my thinking process here is. I think to the extent that Trump is going to do anything in the Middle East, it's going to be first and foremost related to ISIS and Syria because of the way he's positioned himself and where the public is, and perhaps up to a point on the Iran issue. The way I see him as lining up alliances, and he thinks he can have good friends in the Middle East, I see the closest person to him in the Middle Eastern context will be Egyptian President Sisi, for a lot of reasons. They actually see eye to eye on Syria. Sisi has gone against his Saudi funders on Syria and saying we need to cooperate more with Russia on Syria. He doesn't want the Assad regime to collapse, even though he's anti-Assad personally. And he has certainly taken on the Islamist movements. He does, you know, some of the Trump's announcements, other than the ones that are generally Islamophobic, have been music to his ears. And he was the first foreign leader to call him. And I suspect that that this will become an issue. And Sisi certainly thinks that Israeli-Palestinian agreement would move this forward. I suspect that many in the Gulf will be somewhat comfortable with him to varying degrees, not so much on Syria. So I could see, you know, that certainly Arab rulers for their own purposes would like to pacify this front. This is something that is a complicating factor with them. Many of them would like to deal with Israel. They do deal with Israel, but this issue remains. You look at the public opinion on this issue within Egypt, even for Sisi, or particularly in Jordan, which has a much more complicated picture. So I know that they want it, and certainly they will talk to Trump possibly about it, but that's not a priority for them. So when they're dealing with him, they're dealing with their issues with him. When they come and speak with him, they're not going to say, let's deal with the Israel-Palestine question. They all have their bilateral issues first and foremost, unless there is action that brings this issue to the top, which is moving the embassy to Jerusalem or something like that that brings it up. But I don't see the barrier as specifically coming from the Arab world. The Arab world is distracted. I see it more from Israelis and Palestinians, with the divisions within the Palestinians and an Israeli government that obviously doesn't really want a two-state solution, despite of what it says. I mean, that's the problem right now, much more than where the Arabs are.
And this is actually a significant change from the beginning of the Obama administration, where, you know, when Obama was on his way out to Cairo and he stopped in Saudi Arabia, what he heard from all the Gulf leaders was, get a settlement freeze, work this conflict, and then there's all kinds of things we can do, right?
Right. No, I mean, I think Egypt is the place to watch. And I think that, you know, already we're seeing this tremendous cozying up between Trump and Sisi. And that could actually be very helpful in this case of, you know, the constraints on the sort of U.S. pressure on human rights will likely not exist in the next administration. So the positive side, if there is one, is that, you know, this will allow this closer U.S.-Egypt connection that might be able to do a little bit more on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Do you think Egypt can have an impact on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, Martin?
Well, the first thing I'm fairly confident about, because I had an opportunity to talk with President Sisi recently, is that his view of Egypt's role includes moving on the Palestinian issue, that he believes that it's important to promote a secular, tolerant alternative to the theocratic states emerging from ISIS or Iran or Hezbollah or Hamas or the Muslim Brotherhood. And part of that is a peaceful alternative. And the peaceful alternative part of it is a resolution of the Palestinian problem. And he sees that as important. And he sees Egypt as playing a leading role in that. But I you know, on the other hand, he doesn't want to get crosswise with his new friend Bibi Netanyahu because Israel is critical on the security level to the defense of Egypt when it comes to dealing with the situation in Sinai, where there is a branch of ISIS that's very aggressively. So
Israel has also been very important to defending Egypt here in Washington, as Sisi has been cracking down on his own.
Indeed, and I think in this strategic triangle between the United States, Israel, and Egypt, which is what he now sees, and this is a big change in Egypt's approach. And the fact, as Shibley and Sarah say, that Trump and Sisi are going to be close together, and Trump and Bibi, I believe, will as well, that here we have a president-elect who says he wants to solve the Israeli-Palestinian problem because it's the ultimate deal, and an Egyptian president who says it's critical to his role, Egypt's role in the region.
Israeli prime minister who wants to legalize illegal output.
Well, you know, but what's interesting about this from the point of view of somebody who's worked on the Israeli-Palestinian issue for 35 years is somehow it never dies.
Well, I really hope you're right in this case. And unfortunately, we have run out of time today. But I think this final set of comments sets us up perfectly for this evening's gala opening of the Sabah Forum, where we will have a chance to hear from Egyptian Foreign Minister Sameh Shoukry and Israeli Defense Minister Avigdor Lieberman. Those events will be carried live on a webcast on our website, and I urge you all to watch and join in. Thanks for being here.